Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, an old friend of this program, a Democrat who has held that office since 2007 and previously served in the Assembly for two decades. Tom DiNapoli, always a great pleasure to host you here. I'm so glad you're here.
Great to be back, and I love being in the studio, Alan, rather than doing it by phone, so it's great to be here with
you. Well, it's always our pleasure. Let's start by asking you about the major news of the day, which is the release of the public pension. Our public pension in New York State took a hit the same way anybody who had a stock account took a hit. And it was quite bad, wasn't it, for a while?
It was really an historic loss for that meltdown year of 08, 09.
Yeah.
Where, as you point out, every investor, large and small, took a hit. We lost 26% in terms of a negative investment return. So part of the challenge right now has been continuing to work through the impact of that loss. So we've just announced our return for the fiscal year that ended March 31st. And the good news is we have now our third consecutive year of positive return, a 5.96 positive return, a little less than we had last year, but still on the positive side, 3 years in a row in a very volatile up and down market. So I'm very pleased with those results. We continue to have the best funded of all the state pension plans.
Say that again. The best
funded. When you look at it's called a funded ratio.
Sure.
And the federal GAO points out that any plan that is funded 80% or higher is a well funded.
When you say funded, meaning that you have the ability to pay your debts.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Your assets versus your liabilities,
mm-hmm.
And of course it's never a stagnant number. And your goal is to get to as close to 100 as you can. One of the strengths that we've had is because we were so well funded for such a long period of time. When the meltdown happened, we were actually at about 107% funded status over.
And because you were over, you were helping the localities pay their pension things, weren't you?
Well, you can remember the years, Alan, also, where the contribution rate from employers was close to zero.
Sure.
That was a mistake. Because there was, I think, an assumption that the investment returns would always pay for the pensions. That's not the case. So the reality is that when you look over the past 20 years of every pension benefit dollar paid out to a retiree, 82 cents out of every dollar is paid by investment return, not the employer contribution, which is taxpayer dollars, or the employee contribution. We're better than the national average, which is closer to 68 cents out of every dollar is funded through investment return. But the challenge has been, because of that historic loss and meltdown, the way we do our calculation, we take 5 years to work out our numbers. So we're really 3 years into the 5 years of absorbing that historic loss. So even though we have 3 years of positive return, there's still going to be upward pressure on the contribution rate of the employers. Because just think, if we had to absorb a 26% loss in 1 year, imagine what would have happened to the rates. But there's always a lag, I guess, is my point. So the good news is, as long as these markets stay on the positive side, even with the volatility, we are, as anticipated, returning to a more stable level in terms of the kind of investment return we have. So I think that means rates will start to stabilize and go down, but that's still about 2 years off.
Now, Tom, I read somewhere that we were now back where it was when the mud hit the fan.
Close to it, which I think is an important point to put it in clear terms, because sometimes we use so many big numbers and ratios and statistics.
Mm, exactly.
At the time of the meltdown, we were about $155 billion. Now we're up to $150.3 billion. Mm. So that's the highest level we've had since the meltdown. Keep in mind, Alan, that we paid out last year benefits of about $8.5 billion. So when you consider the past 3 years of paying out billions in benefits, and here we are still now over $150 billion for the first time, you could see that we've really done very, very well in recovering and rebounding. But I just want to be clear. it's a tough investment climate out there.
I would say. I wouldn't want your job.
we see what's happening. You know, the shock waves coming out of Europe that continue.
I was going to ask you about that, if I can interrupt.
Sure.
You know, every day we hear about the Greeks potentially changing their currency and all of Europe getting very upset, you know, about this. And immediately the Asian markets go down, which is the first thing you hear about. And then our markets go down in the United States. And you use the word volatility. So I want to talk to you about that. How can you control for volatility when you're a controller and you have this discretion?
Yeah. Well, you can't control it. You do try to limit your risk.
Well, that's what I'm saying. One of the
things we're trying to do, we're very heavily invested and have been for a long time in public equities, the stock markets that people are familiar with. Part of that has to do with the fact that over time, stocks, those kind of equities, give you a good return. The other challenge we have in New York is that we don't have complete discretion. We are what's called a legalist state. There are limitations on where we can put the money. So by definition, in terms of acceptable investments, fixed income, you know, safe investments and public equity stocks are what most of our portfolio has always been in and will continue to be in.
Define fixed income for us.
Fixed income would be treasuries.
I see. Treasury
you know,
notes,
basic,
things like that. Yeah.
Very,
okay.
Very, very stable fixed income, right. High grade instruments. By the way, we did very well. We actually had a return of 9% in our fixed income portfolio, which was really terrific. But that's about 30% of our portfolio. 70% are equities. Most of that is public equities, meaning stocks. We can put some money into what are called alternative investments, private equity, real estate, absolute return strategies, which are hedge funds, commonly known as hedge funds. What we've been trying to do, even within the limits of what we're allowed under the law, is to move. And we're a big ship, so we move slowly. We move more out of public equities where there's this volatility because of Europe and because of what with the up and down of the markets, and move more into the alternatives. So the last time we did our asset allocation, we actually increased the amount available for private equity. We continue to have confidence in real estate as an investment. Mm. So to dampen or control, as you put it, or incorporate into our thinking that there is going to be continued volatility, we're trying to do more in that alternative space. Something like private equity, where you put money in and you don't see the payout for a number of years, our view is that that will weather this time of volatility.
So give us an example for those people who are listening as to a private equity investment.
Well, we just did a tour very recently here in the Capital Region. There's a new tech company called Husay. They have their office down on Broadway right here in Albany. And it's with an entrepreneur, Steve Ellis, who we actually had an investment with a few years ago that did very well. And he's got, I think, about 30 employees, many of them RPI graduates, drawing on local talent. A lot of techies, you know. It's a system where basically they manage the internet activity and publicity, if I could use that phrase, of celebrities, sports figures, movie stars, and so on. And here, you know, this kind of Hollywood glitzy product and technology is being managed right here in Albany. So we have put through our in-state investment, a private equity investment program, an allocation of dollars into Husay. So Steve and his other investment partners, they're working to make the company profitable. After a period of time, typically what happens is we will exit either through somebody else buying the company or a public offering, or the owners themselves will buy back the equity stake. But after a period of time, what will happen is we will get our money back from a successful venture. So we are trying to do more in terms of the emerging high-tech industry that we have all across our state. So that's one example. We may also, that's a startup, we may also invest in a company that's been around for a long period of time. We just did an investment, Sleepy's Mattresses, people have heard of.
Mm-hmm, sure.
They're headquartered on Long Island. It's a long-held family-owned business. They were looking for an infusion of cash. They've invited some equity partners to take a stake in the company. We did an investment in Sleepy's. So it's either a refinance kind of situation, a startup. But the point is we put money in, we let it ride there for a period of time, and after a number of years, usually no less than three, often more typically 5 to 7 years, we will exit at a profit.
Okay. Now, your predecessor got himself into a real trouble by having people you know, basically paying for the where you put your money. I know that you've been very aware of the danger of being perceived in any negative way. How have you controlled for that?
Well, you raise a very important point. The issue largely came about with the use of placement agents, in effect, middlemen, middle people that worked for the firm that was looking for the capital, but would interact with the controller's office. And
sometimes
they would
call these people bagmen.
Well, and you know, part of what happened during my predecessor's tenure is that, in effect, people were being directed, you know, unless you use this particular placement agent, you're not going to get the business.
Yeah.
That at least was the perception, and in some cases, apparently, the reality. And of
course, somebody's in jail for it.
Two people are.
Two people are.
Yep. So what we've done. We took the most clear way to ensure that this wouldn't happen again. We've banned any investment transaction involving a placement agent. So we are one of the few public pension plans that says you got to deal with this directly. No placement agent. Placement agents are a part of the business. They have been for a long time, and obviously most of them are reputable and they do the right kind of job. But we had such a problem in New York. I felt the only way we could be sure that I could guarantee to the public that we're not going to fall into that trap again is to say no more deals involving placement agents.
So wait.
Eliminate it.
So if Sleepy's, Tom DiNapoli, wants an infusion of capital, they can't use a placement agent, how do they come to you?
Anybody comes in a direct way. So they will talk to our staff. And, you know, keep in mind a lot of how our money is allocated right now is that we give money to a fund, and the fund is the one that may actually make the decision of who they interact with. But I always say to any entrepreneur, any entity that's interested in an investment opportunity, contact our office, but deal with us directly. You don't have to go through a middle person.
I want to talk to you about the minimum wage debate in New York, if I can. You know, the governor says this is not the year, but he's for it. I don't want to get you into trouble, but I have my grave doubts. This is a guy who has tremendous clout over the legislature. If he wanted it, he'd get it. He'd get a minimum wage. The Senate is really in debt to him, and that's where it's sort of stopping. I wonder how you feel about it.
Well, you know, I very much respect the role of making the choice, and that is the legislative prerogative and the governor. So I understand as controller, you know, we have a somewhat, you know, removed perspective on this. But my point of view is this, Alan, and I've served in the legislature. Any time we proposed increasing the minimum wage, you kind of have the same debate. It's going to kill jobs. It's bad for business. We're going to lose opportunities. Mm-hmm. The reality is when we've raised the minimum wage in the past, that didn't happen. And in fact, you know, we talk about New York staying competitive and comparable to other states. Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, they have higher minimum wages than we have in New York. So it would seem to me if we want to stay comparable and competitive and be sure to attract and retain, you know, good workers, why wouldn't we want to have at least a level playing field with neighboring states? And the reality is with this very, very tough post-recessionary time we're going through, there are so many working families just on the margins. If we increase the minimum wage, many families will benefit from it in a way that will enhance their security, their spending power. I see that long term as a benefit for us in our state. So I'll leave it to the legislature and the governor to figure out, you know, what the right level is and some of the specifics. But I certainly think the naysayers are wrong in terms of how they're opposing this. And I do hope there will be a positive action taken.
Now, I know that you have been extremely sensitive about who you take money from in your campaign. After all, you don't have to be a genius to figure out if somebody gives you money for a campaign, especially the comptroller, they're going to want the kind of influence that they would like. And I know that, therefore, you're at a real disadvantage because the other guys, the governors and everybody else, are taking huge amounts of money, and you have to be cleaner than Caesar's wife. So how do you afford to run for office if you're in that kind of conundrum?
It doesn't make it easy. And in fact, we actually asked the SEC to impose, not just on a voluntary basis as we were doing it, but really across the board for controller kind of races that you have a prohibition against the so-called pay-to-play contribution.
And didn't Shelley Silver announce that he thought this would be a very good test case for campaign finance
Well,
reform?
On public financing. And I think long-term that's really the answer. Certainly for this office, and I've argued let's start with the controller's office. It makes sense. It's the least partisan of the offices out there. It's
so
the
let's
one
explain
that...
to people. There'll be rules. You raise some money, and the state would match that money.
Exactly. Right? And it's modeled after what I think has worked pretty well in the city. You agree to caps on how much you spend, so you don't have the kind of outrageous amounts of dollars spent on campaigns. You put an emphasis on small donations, so you only match the smaller donations, and then you provide basically a 6-to-1 match on those donations. And the candidates would agree to comply with the spending limits. They'd agree to participate in public debates as part of that.
So if you get a billionaire, Tom DiNapoli, running against you, we know that there are some people out there who would like you to be gone. They can find themselves a billionaire who'll self-fund a campaign. How would this whole thing help you?
I'd like to think it would at least make, not just for me, but for anybody, at least make it a competitive opportunity. Last time out, as you remember, he wasn't a billionaire, but he was multimillionaire. And my opponent had $4 million of his own dollars that he put into the campaign and raised several million more. We ended up spending, I think, about half of that. And we were still able to win. So that was of comfort. But it was very hard to compete in that environment. And I think part of the issue is not only the compromising influence of private donations. We also are at a point in our society where access is key. You know, it's not just about Tom DiNapoli. It's about anybody who's a middle-class person should be able to compete, certainly for statewide office, but even, you know, running for state legislative office could be very expensive. We are closing out so many people because if you don't have that personal money or not an immediate access to raise big dollars, you can feel left out of the box. So I think we're choking off a lot of the talent that could be part of our system, the competition that needs to be part of the system. So, you know, you've got the issue, I know one of your favorite topics, redistricting that we just went through. So you've got a certain imbalance right there. And then on top of it, an unfairness in terms of money being such a key factor. Well, no wonder we don't have the kind of competition in the political process that we should have. So I think it's important on many levels that we provide a level playing field. And I really do think public financing is the only way to achieve that.
So, Tom DiNapoli, you're going to put your hands around my neck and squeeze when I ask you this question. But Governor Cuomo, to my great dissatisfaction, by the way, did not do what he promised, which was to veto the self-serving redistricting bill, which will, of course, help the Republicans stay in office. Now, do you think he should have vetoed that gerrymandering?
Well, you're sitting so far away from me. I can't bring you. Look, I think the goal stated early on by the reform groups, Mayor Koch and others, to have an independent commission play a significant role in the process of drawing the lines made the most sense, especially in state government. We've been trying very hard to restore a sense of credibility into the system, and I think that had they taken that path, it would have made a lot more sense. That didn't happen. It should have. I'm not going to second guess the governor on signing or vetoing. And you're right. You know, obviously the maps favor the Republicans in the Senate, and they favor the Democrats in the Assembly.
Yeah, it's wrong in the Assembly. It's wrong in the Senate. But wait, it seems to me if you're saying, you know, we should have had this independent commission, if the governor was told us he was going to veto any self-serving bill, which he didn't do, that you're basically headline criticizing, controller criticizes governor.
Well, let's just say it would have been preferable had it been done another way. Let's leave it at that. And obviously, moving forward, it's going to continue to be a debate in the constitutional amendment that's being proposed. And you know, we'll see how the details of that play out. It's also interesting, you look at the congressional lines where they couldn't come to an agreement, and a court, you know, did the lines. Some people think the courts were more objective and came up with strong lines. Other people feel the lines, even in that regard, perhaps weren't as good as they could have been had there been a different kind of process. So
you can put me in that group. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just say there's unhappiness all around, but these are the lines, and I'm hoping that it won't discourage good candidates from coming forward.
Tom DiNapoli, I wish this program were an hour. It's not, but I wanted to ask you, everybody's talking about NYRA, the New York Racing Association. Frankly, as Clark Gable once said, I don't give a damn. I don't really understand it. I don't want to understand it. Can you give us, in 2 minutes, a praisey of why everybody cares so much about this?
There's a lot of money involved. There's a big revenue stream, and the gaming industry as a whole, especially with the VLTs and the prospect for casinos and some of them being tied into the tracks, you're talking about a lot of money involved. And NYRA is an organization that's had a bad reputation for a long time. They were given the opportunity to clean up their act. They didn't
do it.
But
you're the guy who found out they were cheating.
That's
you
right.
recently did it, and I don't think, frankly, Tom, that you've gotten the credit you deserve for having blown the whistle on
Well,
them.
We did, but you know, here's the headline of Controller says the governor did the right thing. The governor did the right thing in coming up with a takeover for a period of time of NYRA. Let's hope it can be straightened out. We need to restore credibility
yeah,
to how
the governor
racing is
didn't find it. You found it.
Well,
you know,
but that's our job. That's our job.
Beating your breast and saying, you know, I did it.
That's our job, but I'm glad the governor took the next step to say we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. We're going to change the leadership there in a dramatic way.
An obscure American possession, I believe, the Northern Marianas, their pension system is going under, and they're seeking bankruptcy protection. Many people think that they gave away the store and that the pensions were too generous and too early and when before people retired. Is there any way that could happen in New York?
No. Again, New York has the best funded of all the state plans that are out there, and we're smart. We have a long-term investment strategy. We're well-diversified. We have an independently elected controller that looks out for the assets of the fund, and that's not going to happen in New York.
Okay, have you ever been in the Northern Marianas?
I can't say that I have.
Okay, do you know where they are?
Anyway, a geography test.
Anyway, here you are as controller, and you've been your own man. You've been tough. You have, as I say, exposed the NYRA thing. I'm a little uncomfortable with some of the new arrangements on gambling in the state. I know that your predecessor got into a lot of trouble, as we know, for taking advice from the wrong people or having conflicts. I know you haven't done that. But I am concerned when I see a governor, for example, naming corporations and others who will run the aqueduct racing and the rest. Are you going to be looking over all of their shoulders to make sure that we're not getting in bed with the wrong people?
That we certainly view that as our role with the Genting contract for aqueduct. We actually were charged under the legislation with reviewing that contract, and we did. And we did take the time to do a proper analysis and vetting. You know, part of the challenge with the gaming question is that the legislature often will, because it's such a unique industry, they will have special legislation that deals with the ground rules. I hope they include us in that process of review. You know, I had a concern during this past budget cycle. The legislature, at the governor's request, took us out of the
pre-contract audit.
Exactly. They took us out of that for certain
Why
centralized
contracts.
Why did
they do contracts.
That? Well, it was done supposedly in the name of efficiency, but if you look at the track record, we're very efficient in terms of approving those contracts.
It's absurd. So. It was absurd. I was furious about it when it happened. I wrote columns about it. I talked about it. Why in the world would you take the controller from taking a look at contracts? You don't know if you're getting into bed with a corrupt corporation or something like that. And they did it, didn't they?
They did. And look, there's never any guarantee, but for sure, you know, you have a greater assurance that an approval is happening in the right way when you have an objective, independent set of eyes looking at it. And I hope that'll be included in the gaming decisions that'll be made moving forward. Our office has a track record in terms of that kind of review. We should be at the table. It will give the public more assurance that enough eyes are looking at the agreements that are being reached.
But when you say to the controller you are not allowed to look at contracts before the state lets them, if, assuming you're making them in good time and you are, it stinks like fish or like relatives who come to stay too long.
Well, for decades we had that authority, and I think it was a mistake for it to be taken away. I hope it's not the beginning of a pattern to say, well, you can audit it after the fact. So what good does it do for us to put in our press release saying the contract was bad, it was a bad vendor that you entered in with? It's already done. The taxpayers' money is already
you're
wasted.
Allowed, just to make sure that you're allowed to do it after the
exactly,
fact.
Exactly.
But by that time, the damage is done.
The money's wasted. The taxpayers' interests aren't protected.
Tom DiNapoli, we love having you here. We hope you'll come back often. And if I've said anything to alienate you in any way by putting you on the spot, I hope not. I apologize.
No problem.
It's great to have
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.